Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. The White House says President Obama won't meet with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu when he's in town to address Congress in March. The House fumbles a controversial abortion bill on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And the Justice Department is unlikely to file civil rights charges against Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup, Cheryl Stolberg of the New York Times, Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, and Amy Walter of Cook Political Report. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners, as always, to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number. It's 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And you can also watch video of this hour of the Friday News Roundup streaming live on the web on drshow.org. Well, let's talk first about the State of the Union. Cheryl, the president spoke Tuesday night, smallest audience in 15 years in terms of the TV audience. But he was trying, I think, to set a debate about middle class, what he calls middle class economics. Did he succeed in doing that?
You know, I actually think he did succeed in framing the debate, not only for his last 2 years, knowing that, frankly, none or very few of these proposals will make it through a Republican-controlled Congress, but he's really looking toward setting the agenda, I think, for 2016. In injecting the phrase middle-class economics, he actually sparked a debate among Republicans. We're seeing more Republicans now talk about the middle class. Mitt Romney, who had talked about and was derided for talking about the 47% in his last campaign, is now talking about, you know, ways that we need to address income inequality and the middle class. So I think the president sparked a discussion, all the while knowing that the policies, the specific policies that he's proposing, are pretty much dead on arrival in this Republican Congress.
Ed O'Keefe, you cover Congress every day for The Washington Post. Are these proposals dead on arrival, or is there a chance that some of the things he proposed, some of the big things like raising the capital gains tax or making the first 2 years of community college tuition free, do those have any chance of getting through in the next 2 years?
I think the one that Republicans are most eager to talk about is the child care proposal. The tax credits there. There's an understanding that the fastest way to win working mothers' votes is to focus on things like child care, and both parties obviously are eager to do that. There's a bipartisan proposal that's on the table in the Senate that they're working on, and it's sort of similar to what the president is proposing to do. Basically, would give child care to more than 1 million children over the next decade and tax credits of up to $3,000, a popular proposal. But the tax proposals, you know, his foreign policy, just about everything else, pretty much dead on arrival. And, you know, having sat in the chamber watching it, even for some of his most embellished moments, Republicans were very much just stone-faced and sitting on their hands, many of them actually taking cues from each other. Are we supposed to stand up for that? Do we clap for that? Boehner, do we? Well, oh, okay, he's sitting there, so we're not going to do that. But, you know, there's just this sort of understanding that they won and they control the agenda, as Mitch McConnell said at one point this week. And, you know, they gave the president his night, but otherwise he's not going to have much to say about what they're going to pass.
Well, Republicans may think they won, but, Amy, I did feel like the president seemed just about as liberated and outspoken as he's been in a couple years.
Right. There was the infamous, what they're calling the drop the mic, what the kids call the drop the mic moment, right? That was ad-libbed there at the end of the campaign when he said, at the end of his speech, where he said, I'm not campaigning anymore. Republicans cheered. He said, that's right, because I've already won two of them. And Democrats went crazy. The internet blew up. He is in a very unique position right now, right? This is a guy with nothing to lose. And you could see this after the election, during the lame duck, during this speech. But we also know that this is a president, and quite frankly, I think this is most presidents now in this era, that they are dictated not by what they want to do, but by outside events that they have no control over. So to me, a lot of talk that comes up in the State of the Union, we are going to hear about it. We may hear it debated in Congress or not. We may hear it on the campaign trail in 2016. But fundamentally, I think 2015 is going to be determined as much about what's happening in Yemen than what's going to happen with a tax credit or anything else that was brought up here.
Sure.
You know, I think it's worth actually talking a little bit about that moment, that ad lib where he said, I don't have any more campaigns to run. Republicans kind of snickered. And then he said, I know, because I've already won both of them. And I think that was very, very revealing about the president's character and also about his state of mind. You might remember when he first took office and he met with Republicans in the White House, in the Oval Office, Eric Cantor, then the Republican leader, said to him, made a remark to him, and the president said to Cantor, "Eric, elections have consequences, and I won." But in this case, Republicans can actually make an argument that he didn't win. They won. And a lot of Republicans were, frankly, I think, kind of insulted by the tone of his speech, by the tenor, by him sort of seeming in a cocky way to say, "Hey, I won." You know, that's not how they view it. And I think that really sets up this kind of continuing clash. So, you know, despite the fact that we have talk about, you know, wanting to work across the lines, across the, you know, in a bipartisan way, the mood after that address was clearly anything but bipartisan.
Two quick things about that night. First off, one thing cameras didn't catch, most people couldn't see, is when he said, "I have run my last campaign," the person who clapped the loudest, Michelle Obama. She's up in the rafters.
She didn't want him to run the first one.
Exactly. So she actually was the one that started the clapping, at least from my view. The second thing, though, is, you know, while the president may have lost the midterm elections, talking to a senior Democrat this week, he said, you know, you'd think we won. Because suddenly, as you said, Cheryl, not only is Mitt Romney talking about income inequality, but you're hearing Republicans across Capitol Hill talk about it. Paul Ryan had been trying to talk about this for years and not getting any traction among his colleagues. But there's now an understanding that they've got to do a lot more of that. And so I think that's part of why the president took the tone that he did. It's like, yes, you know, we didn't win the elections, but clearly we are dominating the debate if economic concerns, especially regarding income inequality, are top of mind for both parties.
Well, Amy, you know, we heard complaints from Republicans about the president's tone and about it being unyielding and not laying out the grounds for compromise. But I think a question a lot of Obama supporters have is, would it be any different if he had been much more conciliatory, more moving to the middle?
Right. Well, that's also the irony I was going to bring up to the points that Cheryl and Ed made, which is Republicans won the election, but they didn't really win much, right? They still do not have enough votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. They have a very fractured majority in the House. We're going to talk about some of the problems they have both on their left and on the right, and now we learned this week on their left. So in many ways, the president is quite well positioned, better positioned than Republicans. Republicans also, if you look at the most recent polling after the election, they didn't really win anything since the election. Their approval ratings still incredibly low. The president's numbers, meanwhile, have gone up in the last few weeks. Voters don't expect that Congress is going to get much done. They didn't think that this election was going to change the debate in Washington. They didn't think it was going to end gridlock. Washington still has lower approval ratings than most sexually transmitted diseases. You know, it's just not a good place to be. So he is actually, in many ways, better positioned. And he also knows that, look, he's got about a year, and then 2016 is going to engulf us all.
Another important point, a little legacy building from the president here in this speech. The comments, "The crisis is over. It's time to turn the page." I mean, he really wants to get credit for turning the economy around. And so far, he really, frankly, hasn't gotten that much credit for from the American people. And certainly Republicans have tried to keep him from getting credit. So I think he was also trying to reframe that debate, to maybe take a page out of Ronald Reagan. You know, it's morning in America again, and to try to get Americans to look at his presidency in different terms.
I think it was really the first time during his presidency where the economy seemed good enough that you could take credit for it without looking kind of out of sync with the way most people were feeling, because the jobless rate's down, inflation not a problem, wages still pretty stagnant, but some early signs maybe that's starting to improve.
Yeah, and that's the Republican argument, is that wages are stagnant, that labor participation is still so low, that of course the unemployment rate is going down when fewer people are actually out there looking for work and so many are underemployed. So they continue to stick to that argument. I think that's, frankly, the real legacy of the Tea Party movement, is that we look at these types of numbers in a much more analytical and deeper way than we used to, because they sort of compelled Congress to really think about those concerns. But, you know, whether there's any movement on job-creating legislation or not remains to be seen. And currently, there doesn't really seem to be anything they can agree on that issue.
So lots of countdowns in the last 2 years of the president's term. One of them is visiting all 50 states. Now, yeah. This week, he ticked off another one, Idaho. He also went to Kansas. He had been to Kansas before. Mm-hmm. Three states remain that President Obama has not visited since being elected. Who can tell us who they are?
I think South Dakota, yeah. Utah, yeah. And South Carolina.
Yep.
Very good.
Wow.
Okay, I win the prize. No, Ed wins, too.
We're talking with Ed O'Keefe.
Is there a tote bag here?
Yeah. We're talking this hour with Ed O'Keefe, congressional reporter at The Washington Post. And also with us in the studio, Cheryl Stolberg. She's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And Amy Walter, national editor of The Cook Political Report. When we come back after a short break, we're going to talk about an amazing story about one of America's closest allies coming to give us an address to Congress and it becoming a huge controversy between Israel, the White House, and the Congress. We'll take your calls 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. From Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems, in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. Kelly has sent us an email. She's in Dallas. She writes, I'm 57 years old. I cannot remember a single instance of a foreign head of state being invited to address a joint session of Congress without at least the tacit approval of the president, much less over the clear objection of the White House. Mm-hmm. Can your panel recall any precedent for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's impending address to Congress? And what does it say about Netanyahu that he accepted? And let's take one step back. What has happened here?
What's happened is the morning after the State of the Union, Speaker Boehner dropped his own mic, if you will, by announcing that he had invited the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to come address a joint meeting of Congress to discuss the potential threats from Iran. Now, normally the way this works is the White House and the State Department announce that a foreign head of state is visiting the country. If they really like the guy and his country or her country, they usually get invited to address Congress. The one that sticks out most recently is the president of Ukraine. Former president of South Korea, when he was in charge, also got to do this. Netanyahu has done it twice before. But in this case, Boehner went and did it on his own, and the Israelis agreed to the invitation. He will come in early March, around the same time he's coming to address the annual AIPAC meeting here in Washington. So originally they wanted him to come in February. Netanyahu said he was fine to do that. They moved it, and there's been chatter in the Israeli and American press that perhaps the reason he did that was because he realized how much he had upset the White House. So by using the convenience of the APEC meeting, he said, well, then I'll go stop by the Capitol and share my thoughts.
Well, you know, he did not only didn't confer with the White House, he didn't tell the White House until the news was basically being released. And to Kelly's question, can anyone recall a precedent for this happening?
No. In fact, I was, thanks to the wonder of the Internet, looking at Twitter and Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News, you know, reminded us that, you know, the last time you can kind of remember something like this was like with General MacArthur getting sacked. And then you had the Speaker of the House inviting him to speak to Congress as a clear in your face to Truman. But other than that, you know, you can't kind of go to something that was international and obviously something with tremendous international consequences, which is the sanctions on Iran. What was also interesting is now you're watching both sides sort of leak things back and forth. You know, what came out yesterday was the fact that the Israeli intelligence agency saying, oh, by the way, you know, this Iran sanctions bill they're talking about in Congress, should that pass, that would have major repercussions, something that obviously the president's been saying. So you know, this helping to sort of bolster his case.
We're going to talk more about the Iran sanctions proposal in our second hour, our international hour. But it is true that Speaker Boehner, Republicans, and some Democrats were upset by the president's language in the State of the Union, rejecting the idea of tougher sanctions on Iran. That's, of course, something that Israel very much wants to see.
Exactly. And, of course, on the Senate side, Senator John McCain, very much, who's the new chair of the Armed Services Committee, very much opposed to this. So this invitation really not only – it serves – certainly Speaker Boehner's political aims to kind of poke the president, although he said very pointedly yesterday, I'm not poking anyone. It also serves Prime Minister Netanyahu's aims. Right. No secret that Netanyahu and President Obama do not see eye to eye, do not get along. And so this was a way for both Israel and the Republicans in Congress to get together and basically, you know, put pressure on the president. And the White House is very miffed about this. Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, said yesterday that, you know, protocol would ordinarily dictate that when our president goes to a foreign country, we alert the leader, the head of state of the other country, and that didn't happen here, and they are making no secret that they are miffed about this.
We live in a post-protocol Washington, clearly. I think one thing to keep in mind here, because there's been a lot of chatter about the fact that the White House has said they will not meet with Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. The reason they give, and there is precedence for this, is that there's an election in Israel just 2 weeks after this visit. The example of this I can recall is at one point the labor leader in the United Kingdom came to the U.S., and his visit was such that it came right just a few months before the re-election of David Cameron, essentially. And the White House said, we can't meet with him because it's too close to the election. So there is precedence for avoiding conversations with top leaders close to their own elections to not appear to be swaying them. But I know, of course, people are seeing that as a bit of a snub. Of course, if the White House wanted to break protocol, since everyone seems to be doing it, they probably could.
Yeah. But, okay, I'll tell you an election that's not close, and that's the 2016 presidential election. And yet it is all over the news. A scoop. John Carl of ABC has a scoop this morning about Marco Rubio. He has said he won't run both for re-election to the Senate and for the presidency. And according to John Carl, he's taking some steps that indicates he'll do what we thought he might not do, given Jeb Bush's interest in running for president, and that is run for president himself. Amy,
that's
tell
right.
us what's happening.
So it sounds like, again, that thanks to John Carl from ABC reporting on this, that he's hiring up a very strong fundraiser. He has a fundraising goal in mind. He's spending the weekend and actually the week down in Miami huddling with supporters. He's going to take time off from being in the Senate to actually lay out with his team, you know, what a campaign would look like. He is going on a book tour as well, as one does when they are thinking about running for president. You got to write a book. Look, to me, Marco Rubio's path goes like this. Yes, having a former governor from your home state who is also your mentor running is problematic. But I think the bigger problem for Marco Rubio has always been this, which is he's very young. He's 43 years old. He's a first-term senator. Before that, he had about 9 years in the state legislature. That's his entire body of work.
And it
sounds
familiar.
Kind of very familiar. One-term, right. Young, charismatic. Oh, right. So making the case to Republicans beyond problems that he has, you know, from a Jeb candidacy, that to me is more striking. So, but, you know, again, he's young. He has the opportunity to try this out. And quite frankly, why not? Nobody knows what Jeb's going to be like on the campaign trail. This is somebody who hasn't run since 2002. This is somebody who has angered the right, obviously, on a number of issues. So why not get out there, be in the mix, see what happens?
And yeah, I interviewed Mike Huckabee yesterday. He also has a new book out. You're right. There is no shortage of books by potential presidential candidates. And we hear even Lindsey Graham, who we hadn't really thought of, the senator from South Carolina, as a presidential prospect, saying he's interested in exploring the idea. You get the feeling, Cheryl, that Republicans think this might be a year, despite Hillary Clinton's considerable strength, that they could win the White House back.
Yes, and I think you also get the feeling that the Republicans are really not willing to just cede their turf to Jeb Bush. I mean, look at what's happened since Jeb Bush said that he was going to run. First, you know, we had the resurrection of Mitt Romney, you know, coming back for number three. If you ask Republicans around the country, do they think he should do it? You get a lot of, well, it's a free country. And and, you know, the more the merrier, the more the merrier. So now you have Marco Rubio, who possibly could be positioning himself for a vice presidential candidate. We don't know that Jeb Bush is going to be the nominee. Let's say someone else is the nominee. Marco Rubio would be a very, very attractive person. Hispanic. He's got a nice personal story. He's broken with his party a little bit on immigration, although sort of moved back a little bit on that. So why not? So it seems like Republicans are really not ready to settle down and coalesce around one person.
We have a couple cattle calls, we call them, for Republicans this weekend. One in Iowa with Steve King. There's another in California with the Koch brothers. And we had a kind of secret meeting, not so secret, I guess, since it made the front page of the New York Times, between Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney yesterday in Utah. What was that about, Ed?
It was, according to both camps at this point, previously scheduled, as Bush announced that he was thinking about this, to go sort of kiss the ring of the former GOP nominee. And what it turned into is a sort of, so are you going to run? Well, I don't know. Are you going to run? Kind of meeting. Exiting it, the aides say it was a cordial exchange and that it was, a meeting of the minds. But there were no conclusions, no deals cut. And no sense that either guy is ceding ground. Romney's supposed to huddle with his advisors today and over the weekend up in Boston. Bush is giving a speech at an auto dealers convention in San Francisco. That's a sure sign that you're running for president. You're talking to the auto dealers. And then all the other candidates are either in Iowa or Palm Springs this weekend for two meetings with big constituencies. Obviously social conservatives in Iowa and the Koch brothers and their friends out in California.
Amy, do Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney get along? Are they friends? Do they like each other?
I mean, it seems as if they do. And I mean, there are all sorts of stories about, you know, past transgressions and somebody not liking somebody else or not feeling like they were good enough or helpful enough. But at the end of the day, both of these candidates have to figure out where they are able to go to win the nomination. I think Mitt Romney looks at the polls. He looks at what he did in 2014 for other candidates, which was he was a very popular surrogate, got a lot of attaboys from people on the trail in 2014. You should have won kind of messaging from people. Gets very encouraged by that, encouraged by the polls that show him on top, not by a big percentage, but out there. Jeb Bush, he's got the name, he's got the infrastructure. His name continues to be a problem for him, however. And to me, that's the question, which is, what Jeb Bush's opportunity with his name is it gives him access to donors and infrastructure. Obviously, it brings the baggage with it. He has a story to tell. He's very different than his brother. Not many people know about Jeb Bush. The question is, will they be open enough to listen to his pitch, or will they just say, this is another Bush, I don't have time for this?
So just briefly, on the other side, we had Joe Biden, the vice president, ask if he might challenge Hillary Clinton in 2016, and he said, quote, there is a chance. Do you think there's a chance, Cheryl?
Honestly, I don't.
No.
I think that,
not.
Joe Biden needs to say there's a chance, because if he doesn't say there's a chance, he's completely written off for his next 2 years, and he wants to remain an effective vice president. And part of remaining effective is seeming relevant to perhaps even foreign leaders who could might want to think, well, he could be the future president, so we better be nice to him. But I always said about Joe Biden is kind of like the Tony Bennett of politics, right? Little kids love him and old ladies love him. And he is very likable. He's charming, but he comes with his own drawbacks. He's gaffe prone, as we all know, not to mention his age. He would be 74 when he ran. That is an age that, you know, would that people will look at and will want to examine. Is he up for it? And he hasn't done any of the things that you would need to do. He hasn't built an apparatus. He says that he can decide during the summer. I think the summer is too late. By the summer, Hillary Clinton will probably already have been announced. And I just don't see it happening.
And she's also 40 to 50 points up in the polls over
exactly.
Joe Biden, which is the most important piece.
I think there's a lot of Democrats who are close to the dimmer switch, if you will. In the event that they need to start cranking it up, if Hillary Clinton decides to not run for whatever reason, you could probably put Martin O'Malley and Andrew Cuomo and people like that in the same category. But you're right. If she's running, if she's full steam ahead, polling alone dictates that none of them have a chance. Mm-hmm. I mean, this isn't even like, you know, Mario Cuomo, Bill Clinton, Al Gore numbers 1988. This is astronomical and beyond that.
You know, I would just say one thing. As somebody who's covered, more presidential elections than I'd want to admit, that sometimes you're surprised. Sometimes things happen that you don't expect. Somebody you're sure is going to run doesn't run. Somebody who's going to be a powerhouse candidate turns out to have a glass jaw. So I think that is probably encouraging people like Marco Rubio and Joe Biden not to say no.
Never.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org. Let's go to the phones. We'll talk first to Patty. Patty, you've been really patient. Thanks for holding on.
Oh, you're welcome. I was calling because ever since the Republicans won the Senate as well as the House, the mantra was, well, now they have to govern. And I feel like that abortion law yesterday was off to a bad start for them. That they didn't even know that their own membership would have enough people who would say, you can't have an undue burden on women when it comes to abortion. You know, that's something Sandra Day O'Connor was always made sure to repeat. And I'm sorry, I'm not to be a blazing partisan, but this time last year I didn't have health insurance, and I was in the emergency room getting a bracing treatment. So thank you, Obamacare.
All right, Patty. Thank you very much for your call. And, you know, Ed, I think there were some Republican House leaders who were surprised by how this unfolded.
Yeah, Patty is telegraphing the concerns that had been expressed by about all of the 22 women who are in the House Republican Conference who said, look, we are anti-abortion. It is a bedrock GOP principle, but this is going too far. And the reason this bill went too far is it allowed the exceptions for health of the mother, incest, and rape. But in the incidents of rape, a woman would have to report the rape to law enforcement before she could get the abortion. That was seen as a step too far for not only a lot of women who are incredibly conservative, were elected as part of the Tea Party wave in 2010, but who said, no, I cannot support that. They were joined by several dozen men, frankly, moderates, mostly from the Northeast and from Florida, who said, also, I stand by the three exceptions to abortion, but I would never tell a woman what she's supposed to do after she's raped. For that reason, after about 3 weeks of wrangling behind the scenes, leaders had to abruptly pull it and vote instead on a bill they've approved before that essentially bans taxpayer funding for abortion.
Is this an example? You know, we've talked about the slowly increasing number of women in the Senate and the House. Is this an example of that actually making a difference?
Sure. I think that's absolutely true. And to understand how difficult it is when you are in the majority and you're trying to get all of your votes from your side, there's no such thing anymore as trying to find votes from across the aisle. Remember, there are five Democrats left in the House who sit in districts that Obama did not carry. Okay, so when you're looking for people to bond with on the other side, there aren't many of them left. So you got to get them all from your team. There are a lot of disagreements that 20 or 30 people disagreeing with you derails a bill. I think it's also important, and Ed brought this up earlier, the importance to many Republicans, conservatives, moderates, about doing better among women voters. Look, they look at the 2014 elections. They did very well, but they continued to do poorly among women. They're not going to win in 2016 if they don't do better among women and among younger voters. So they may not be able to win them over, but it would be a good idea for them not to actually push them away.
I mean, take the case of Renee Elmers, who comes from the suburbs of Raleigh. And we know we have a lot of listeners from North Carolina. You probably know who you are, ladies, if you're listening. I mean, you are a suburban woman who is intrigued by the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. But you might have voted for Renee Elmers in previous congressional elections. She does the math and says, in 2016, if Hillary Clinton's on the ballot and we're doing this kind of stuff, I might lose that woman's vote. I can't afford to vote for this kind of bill. Now, she voted for it 2 years ago. She's just as conservative as all the others on everything else. But you're right, Susan. This is a very joint observation. I think a lot of people missed this yesterday. This was not about moderates revolting. This was about a larger number of women now being in the Republican caucus and having the strength in numbers to say to leadership, we can do this, but we can only do so much of it, and we run the risk of losing their votes.
We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a rare protest at the Supreme Court. We'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850, and we'll read your emails, drshow@wamu.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects while undergoing treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From Constant Contact, providing small businesses and nonprofits email and online marketing tools to engage customers and connect with new ones. For sending newsletters, promoting events, and tracking results. More at constantcontact.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the international hour of the Friday News Roundup. Yemen's government collapses after a rebel takeover. U.S. lawmakers renew calls for tougher sanctions against Iran. And American and Cuban officials meet in Havana for the first time in decades. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And for our news roundup, we're joined by Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. Ed O'Keefe, he covers Congress for the Washington Post. And Cheryl Stolberg, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And you can actually see our guests this hour on our live video stream. You can watch it at drshow.org. Here's an email we got from Marion, writing us from Louisville, Kentucky. And we've gotten a couple along these lines. She writes, the Republicans ran on job creation in the economy, and their first act is to pass anti-abortion legislation. So much for bait and switch. Let's go to Rhonda. She's calling us from Murphy, Texas. Rhonda, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Yes, please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Rhonda. You're on the air. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. I would like to address this in particularly to the people who are journalists or reporters, whether that's print or TV. Why is it, in my opinion, and I used to be a newspaper reporter here in Murphy, why is it that the current group of journalists seemingly do not press our elected officials on doing what they say they're elected to do? The email kind of addresses that. If you say you're for jobs, if you say you're for increasing the participation in the workforce, if you say you're for health care, where is their program? Instead of saying, saying no to whatever the president opposes, even if they were programs that Republicans in years past, they were Republican programs like health care, like educational benefits. Why is it that the people who are charged with bringing the message to the public do not call these people on their bait and switch tactics so that we as the public will have a clear understanding of who we're actually electing rather than being stuck with them for 2 years or 4 years or even 30 years when they have not delivered on the messages that they were voted to on the messages that they presented to the voters in the first place?
All right, Rhonda, thanks so much. Rico, we've got some reporters here. Let me give them a chance to respond. Cheryl?
Well, I guess I would take issue with the notion that reporters don't challenge and don't ask questions. Certainly when the president's health care bill was moving through and all the times that Republicans have said they wanted to repeal Obamacare, there were many, many questions about what they wanted to do. What would Republicans do to replace Obamacare? I can recall my colleague Jonathan Weissman actually wrote a whole story about Ed Gillespie, who ran for Senate in Virginia and had a proposal, his own proposal for health care. And Jonathan wrote in the pages of my newspaper, The New York Times, about how unusual this was for Republicans, that here was one running for Senate actually articulating a proposal. So I think we do call them to task, but I'll defer to my colleagues here to see what they think.
It's only the third full week of the year. Congress has only been in session for 3 weeks. It's just take our time. Republicans would say they have already passed some job creation bills. They have moved to authorize the Keystone XL pipeline, which they say would create about 35,000 construction jobs. They are working on some other legislation to tweak the health care law. And part of the reason you saw the revolt among Republicans yesterday on the abortion bill was they said, this is not what we were elected to do. We were elected to do exactly what Rhonda was talking about, create jobs, focus on the economy, and not these wedge issues.
Rhonda, thanks so much for your call. You know, Amy, the Supreme Court is usually a pretty solemn place, but the court session was disrupted this week on the fifth anniversary of the campaign finance ruling that we call Citizens United. What did the protesters do?
I think that they were sounds like they were yelling about the Citizens United case. One of them actually had been protesting this before. There were just a handful of these folks. But as you pointed out, Susan, this is not something you normally see. You see protesters on the outside, but very rarely on the inside. And the justices were not hearing a campaign finance case. This was just people who were there frustrated about it. It is on the anniversary, but they weren't not hearing a current case about this.
So 5 years since Citizens United, the thought when the decision came down that was really opened the floodgates to an unprecedented flow of money into campaigns. Has that happened, Cheryl?
Well, I think it absolutely has happened. Look at the role of the Koch brothers who are holding this summit, this gathering this weekend. Absolutely. We have seen a heavy, heavy flow of unrestricted cash into campaigns, and that's what these protesters were doing at the Supreme Court. I honestly thought it was very notable. I mean, the Supreme Court is really kind of the last bastion of civility and decorum in Washington. It's a place that has been almost sacrosanct. We're still having debates over whether or not to televise the proceedings. They don't even televise the proceedings in the Supreme Court. And what these protesters obviously had to do was plan to get tickets. It's hard to get in line and get into the Supreme Court chambers. There's limited seatings. And then they did what the Code Pink group often does up on Capitol Hill is, you know, in the middle of the proceedings, stand up and start shouting, you know, we're the 99%. Money is not speech. And so it was kind of shocking. And I actually wonder, is this a turning point? Is the Supreme Court no longer sacrosanct.
Like I said earlier, Cheryl, we are in post-protocol Washington,
exactly.
So clearly something must be afoot. And you're right, I'm kind of amazed that this doesn't happen more often. But there were plenty of protests outside this week, of course, between that anniversary and the Roe v. Wade anniversary.
The last time, I think, was 1983. Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, had an outburst in a case about libel and was promptly escorted out, as were these protesters.
You know, there's no chance that these protests affect what the justices do.
That's right.
It does shine a spotlight on their issue, as exemplified by the fact we're talking about it here this morning. Let's talk to Mary. She's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mary, hi. Thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I just had a comment. I think that the Democrats should use in their commercials when they run in 2016 the response of the Republican Party when the president said that women should get equal pay as men for doing the same job.
And what was the response?
Nothing.
All right.
Nothing. The Democrats all stood up, and Boehner and the rest of the Republicans just sat there and did nothing.
All right, Mary, thanks very much. Ed, you were in the chamber during
She's right.
the speech.
I was keeping track on things like that, and yeah, they sat on their hands. I mean, the issue there for them is not so much about gender equality, it's more the principle of telling private companies what they should and should not be doing and how they should be spending their money. But you're right, the optics of that were a little weird because Democrats were on their feet almost immediately, and Republicans, for the most part, stood silently or sat silently.
Mary, thanks so much for your call. The Senate began debate on revising the education laws, which George W. Bush pushed through Congress, the No Child Left Behind Act. What is likely to change? Is something likely to change, Amy?
Well, there's a lot of talk. There's been a lot of talk, and if you are a school-aged parent, as I am, you know a lot about this, which is about testing and how much we test students and why we're testing them and does it work. And what you started to hear in the debate on the Senate side was from both sides saying this is not necessarily just Democratic or Republican. This is all as well about whether these are effective in gauging whether students are meeting certain goals, whether the testing is adequate way to teach students how to do certain things. What I thought was interesting is, you know, you have a number of folks from the left, especially folks who are from traditionally disadvantaged communities, saying these actually are very good tools for us because it would be easy to just discount our schools. Now we have tools that say, you know what, our schools are or are not meeting these certain standards. We deserve to get the extra attention, the extra money that goes into this, rather than being ignored. You have a lot of other school districts, and in some cases, some wealthier school districts that say, you know what, these tests are sort of silly. They prevent our teachers from being creative. They prevent our students from being critical thinkers. They're now just rote test-taking machines. So I do think this is something that's actually engaging both sides, and it's not necessarily an easily partisan divide.
And what about your own experience with your kids taking all these tests?
I don't want to get my kid in trouble, but I have a problem in some cases that it's, you know, you're starting to prepare kids in kindergarten for their tests that they're going to be taking in third grade, and I just I don't know that that's necessarily important.
The toughest admissions I ever went through was getting my kids into preschool. After that, everything was easy, Cheryl.
Right. I might be naive about this, but I actually have some hope that this could be one area of bipartisan cooperation on Capitol Hill. But, you know, it's being spearheaded by Lamar Alexander, who's a former education secretary, a Republican from Tennessee, but someone who is known as being thoughtful and moderate and willing to extend a hand across the aisle. And as Amy said, this is not necessarily an issue that cuts along party lines. Education affects everyone. When George Bush passed the No Child Left Behind Act, or proposed it early in his presidency, he got bipartisan cooperation from Ted Kennedy. Now, Kennedy eventually turned against him and against this law and was disenchanted because he felt that the federal government didn't fund it enough. But I think education is one issue. Kids tend to be one issue in Washington where the parties have been able to work together traditionally on issues like child health care, et cetera. So a small glimmer of hope. But
if kids were the uniting issue, we would have solved immigration by now. I don't think this one has much hope outside of the Senate. I think you're right. Lamar Alexander and a bunch of Democrats who are concerned about this from both sides, either too much testing or it's working, could come up with some modest changes. But even Arne Duncan, the education secretary this week, said there's a 50-50 chance that this gets done. Even if it gets out of the Senate, where bipartisanship needs to, you know, foster progress or is required to get anything done, you go over to the House where things are a little more intractable, and I think it would be a very, very tough climb.
Marshall's been very patient holding on. He's calling us from Johnson City, Indiana. Hi, Marshall.
Johnson City, Tennessee. Thank
Johnson
you.
City, Tennessee. I'm sorry. That's my mistake. I saw that T and it looked like an I.
Rock me, Mom.
Good morning, right? Susan, and to your panel.
Right? Please.
My question is concerning the last midterm election, the failure of the Democrats to capitalize on the gains that the administration had made. And does it say anything, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, does it say anything that the voter turnout, which is traditionally low during the midterms, was exceptionally low during this past midterm, and maybe that is why the president feels feels free to continue with his agenda and ignoring the quote-unquote referendum that was made against him during that election?
Marshall, that's such a good question. Let's ask our elections expert, Amy Walter, who's here with us.
No, Marshall brings up a very good point, which was turnout definitely was low, was lower than we had seen even in 2010. Not surprising, again, for a midterm election to have lower turnout than a presidential election. But we knew one thing about this election, which was it was taking place mostly in Republican areas. So a lot of the arguments that Democrats are making now on a national perspective. The Senate races, very red territory. So the defense of the president is not going to be very popular in a very red state. You found senators on the Democratic side trying to avoid them. Here's what we do know, though. The people who make the least money, the people who are the most financially insecure, those people turned out at a very low rate, which is why you're hearing Democrats talking about we got to re-engage them. If we get those voters up to about 50% like we did in 2012, that's how we turn the debate for Democrats.
Amy, you'll probably know the answer to this. I don't. What percentage of eligible voters actually voted in November?
It was lower than 50%, I think, ultimately.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, and you can watch what we're wearing and how we look as well as what we're saying by going to our live video stream, drshow.org. Well, Cheryl, Republicans debating the net neutrality bill. Now, this is a complicated subject that often confuses me. What is the issue here with this net neutrality bill?
I think the issue here is whether or not access to the internet should be even across the spectrum, so that companies should not be able to, according to the administration, buy their way into faster internet service. The Obama administration and Democrats would like the internet regulated in a utility-like fashion to prevent a company, say, like the New York Times from paying all kinds of money, not that we're proposing to do this, to get people onto our website in a really quick way, and then if some other competing newspaper were going to, you know, not pay that fee, then it would be much harder, let's say, for consumers to get onto that website. Republicans and the telecom industry are opposed to this. They don't want another burdensome regulatory structure governing the internet. They would like to attack this problem in a different way. They're proposing legislation that they say would block or slow down this kind of uneven access without this super regulatory structure.
And we think the FCC, Ed, may issue these new traffic rules for the internet next month.
Right. And Republicans were eager to move this quickly. I think Democrats were saying there's no need to rush this. The FCC will do its thing. If Congress comes around to it, we can do our thing. On this one, just like with education reform, there actually is hope for some bipartisan progress. This is an example of what is Congress going to do next after Keystone, after repealing parts of Obamacare. It's these types of issues that have been on the back burner for so long. Internet regulation, cybersecurity, education reform. These are things that both parties have been eager to talk about, and that at least Mitch McConnell has been very eager to foster conversation about in the coming months.
Reports this week that the Justice Department has decided not to pursue civil rights charges against Darren Wilson. He's that police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, who shot an unarmed black man, Michael Brown. Lots of disputes about what happened in that incident. A surprise, Amy, that the Justice Department is apparently not going to pursue charges?
Not really. I mean, it is a very, very high bar in order to get a decision on this. You would have to show that there was an intentional deprivation of civil rights. There was willful malice. I mean, these are very difficult things to be able to do. And I think we knew that going in into this case. So, again, it's not particularly surprising. I don't know that it's going to spark the kind of protests that we saw after the first decision of the grand jury, but it certainly is going to keep this issue in the spotlight.
What do you think, Cheryl?
I agree with Amy. I think it was no surprise after the grand jury in Missouri did not indict Darren Wilson that it would be difficult to get federal indictment. The investigation didn't reveal, the FBI investigation didn't reveal anything much different than the Missouri investigation. One thing to note, though, the broader civil rights probe of the Ferguson Police Department on allegations of discriminatory practices in arrests and stops continues. Mm-hmm. So we will see what happens there if the government finds more of a broad pattern of discrimination.
Cheryl Stolberg of the New York Times. And we've also been joined this hour by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post. Thank you for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.